Welcome to First Fuel, a podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Ruth Kempner. Ruth works in the European Commission's Directorate General for Energy, and we're delighted, Ruth, that you've got yourself up so early in the morning to talk to us today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Ruth, I want to get into Fit for 55. There's a lot to cover in that space. But before we do, I think we should alert our listeners that you actually have a connection to Australia. What was that?
Indeed. July 2004, I jumped on an airplane to do my PhD at the University of Sydney. I think it was one of the first times I went overseas. And I spent 3.5 lovely years in Sydney. Loving the barbies, going to the beach, and the footy. Australians even managed to get me into cricket, which I would have never, ever expected. So, I'm still carrying those scars with me throughout today.
But who do you support, Ruth? That's the question.
Oh, I was in Sydney, yeah. So we had the... in Balmain, what is the team in Balmain?
I'm a Victorian, so I've got no idea. Okay. So we'll both have to plead ignorance on that front. But I understand from
the Tigers. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, there you go. And Ruth, while you're here, you weren't just doing a PhD, but it was actually on a subject relevant to, I guess, the area of energy efficiency, energy management that we're here at the Energy Efficiency Council so interested in.
Yes, indeed. So we worked on at that point in time and making energy models, looking at how you can reduce energy and decarbonize energy in industrial networks, industrial clusters. But I also dipped my toe into the buildings sector, for example, trying to make some money writing reports on what was called the low energy high rise buildings report, looking at how you can kind of reduce emissions, actual emissions in office buildings instead of just designing them energy efficient. We're going back a long time.
Well, we've established your bona fides, but since then you've been very busy, and most recently working with the European Commission on this really exciting and comprehensive set of proposals that sit under the Fit for 55 program. We're going to dig into them, but before we do, I wonder if you might set the table for us. How does the EU see the task before it? Obviously known for a high level of ambition in this space, probably one of the leading regions of the world in terms of talking about the need to be quite proactive in dealing with climate. How is the EU travelling as we enter the 2020s, and how does it see the task before it?
So I joined the European Commission 2016, so the year after the Paris Agreement, and what was then at that point on the table was really Europe's pledge to reduce CO2 emissions with at least 40% in 2030. And already, actually, when I arrived, that's why I came there, the task was indeed that we had renewable and energy efficiency targets for 2020, and we needed to update those for 2030. We did that in 2018, where we came up with new targets. And already then, due to those targets, we saw we would overshoot our target of 40% to have at least 55% reductions. The new commission came in 2019. We had the public in Europe being more and more supportive of climate action. And actually, one of the first tasks which we did was indeed raise that target again. So actually we've gone in 5 years from a target of minus 40 to a target of now minus 55%. So it really means that as we move along, actually the ambitions are becoming higher and higher and bigger and bigger, simply also because we see in Europe that the cost of inaction will be very, very high, and that we also have a moral leadership there to kind of push the emissions and get to a climate neutrality, which is now being put in law in the EU in 2050.
So a very keen sense of urgency, and I think I picked up in those Fit for 55, the framing documents that sit around it, a strong view that this next decade is a really critical one for action. This is not something where we can, you know, look to the 2030s or the 2040s for driving that transition. We need to really accelerate that transition immediately. Is that fair?
It's absolutely fair. I think in the package, in the Fit for 55 package, you really have two elements to it. First of all, I think we've introduced policies now which we would have not been able to do if we would not have that climate neutrality target in 2050, because that really means that also for the industry, for anyone who builds a house, they have certainty. In 2050, we need to be climate neutral. So if you do an investment in an industry, if you build a house today, that house needs to be climate neutral. Be able to be climate neutral in 2050. So I think that's really an important element, having that long-term perspective. And then the second, indeed, like you said, is that we cannot wait. We really have to make those transitions as soon as possible. And also we see this period up to 2030 as a period where we need to make sure that in all end-use sectors, we decarbonize. We did a great job in the power sector. And just like Australia, actually, renewables, you know, costs have come down. So the share of renewable is rapidly increasing in the power sector. But buildings, transport sector and industry are still the ones which are lagging. And there, you know, the combined combination of energy efficiency, renewable energy and electrification, key element there, will need to be. Those foundations need to be laid today and be ready in 2030 in order to get to our 2050 targets.
All right. Well, let's get into the detail. And I should say to our listeners, this is a huge package of reform which is being proposed by the European Commission. We can't possibly do it justice. There's things around updated land use regulations. There's stricter CO2 performance standards for vehicles and the like. There's a whole bunch of stuff that in there, and I encourage you, if you're interested in that broader package, to go and look it up. We're going to focus in on the specific energy related elements of the program. And so before we dive into what I think we'll spend most of our time talking about, which is some of the energy efficiency and renewable provisions, just in broad terms, which are the chunks of the Fit for 55 program that someone that's with an interest in energy policy and energy transition should be aware of, Ruud?
It's strange. Like when the policy proposals were introduced, the commissions were very proud that it was 12,000 pages of policies. I'm not sure whether we should be proud of that, because indeed there's a lot in there, and it's almost impossible if it's not your main task to get through it. But I think we have to kind of also, when you start looking at it, keep in mind that this is not something completely new. So we had, like I said, in 2018 already a massive revision where we set targets, we updated our targets for renewable energy. One of the key elements there, which we did also, was introduce a much more kind of citizen-oriented approach. So people putting solar PV panels on the roof got the right to kind of self-produce, self-consume, etc. Energy efficiency, there we already went massively higher in 2018, going from this 20% target, which we met in 2020, to at least minus 32.5% in 2030. And we put this electricity market policy in place, which I think is also very important, really kind of driving the need for flexibility, in particular also through demand response. So that's relevant for both renewable energy and energy efficiency. So that was already there in 2018. So if you now look at the package, there are some continuation of policies, which was already established, but also some new ones. I think the continuation has also to do with essentially the kind of what we call the post-recovery program. We have now 670 billion euros in a post-recovery program, and member states can use that money to do different kind of projects. However, they have to spend at least 40% of that on the green transition. And there are topics like, I think 17 member states have already developed those plans, renewable energy, the production of renewable hydrogen, renovations of public and private buildings, energy efficiency in small and medium-sized enterprises, and also strengthening kind of urban transport infrastructures are some of those key issues where now a lot of member states are spending money. So those are also elements which we see strengthened in the policy proposal, because we have now the policy and the money together in order to make that happen.
It is the case that, we're at this incredible juncture, which is, this ratcheting up of ambition at the very moment in which, the European Union, as every nation and region around the world, is kind of charting that course or attempting to chart a course for recovery post COVID-19. And I think certainly prior to the election of the Biden administration, that was really the European Union that was most forthright in kind of hardwiring that economic recovery narrative to also a narrative of climate transition. And it's a really fascinating confluence of events and underlines the opportunity we have to use that sort of very necessary stimulus to start driving that transformational change, particularly in some of those parts of the economy that are harder to shift and really need support from government to make that transition.
Yeah. And I think, of course, Europe cannot do that alone. The G20 as a whole, including Australia, will need to take that leadership role in order to achieve our 2050 targets. But on the other hand, I also see kind of there some of those new elements in the Fit for 55 package. For example, our European emissions trading scheme, which we've always seen as a pillar of our climate ambitions, is now going to be extended to the buildings and the transport sector, and indeed those more hard to decarbonize sectors. But that will also really starting to affect people. It will mean that those people which continue to use fossil fuels will need to pay those carbon taxes. Previously, it was just the industry, but now it will be, households and people who continue to drive diesel and gasoline cars. So this is also, I think, a new step in this Fit for 55 package. And with that comes also a new kind of understanding that we need to do this transition together. So there's a lot of more funding available for indeed the people still living in energy poverty, which is still 34 million people households in Europe, and also kind of make sure that they can make that transition, that they can make those investments. And I think then last but not least, of course, this is the first time we put in place also a piece of legislation which looks actually internationally, how can we ensure and encourage other countries to make that transition as well. It's something called the carbon border adjustment mechanism, where we're essentially saying that for some of those key CO2 intensive, energy intensive products which are being imported into the EU, we want to make sure that those products have in one way or another paid a carbon price, either at home or through some kind of mechanism linking it to our European emission trading scheme.
It's worth noting for listeners at home, if you're interested in that topic of the carbon border adjustment mechanism, we went long on that just a couple of weeks ago with a local expert, Ruta Tennant-Reed, who is head of energy, climate and environment policy at the Australian Industry Group, who has prepared a really interesting paper which analyses the EU CBAM, argues that it's not something that Australia should be afraid of. There's every prospect that we should be actively considering the role of carbon border adjustments to support our own trade exposed industries through a transition under a future climate policy. So anyone that's interested in the CBAM and the interactions of climate and trade policy, I direct you to that episode with Tennant, which is in the Energy Efficiencies Council's podcast feed. But I think you've given us a good sense of the breadth of the programs that are encompassed in the Fit for 55 program. I'm sort of keen, given the things that we're interested in here at the Energy Efficiency Council, to do a deep dive perhaps on the energy efficiency element of it, which is kind of encompassed in the Energy Efficiency Directive. You mentioned the ambition has been ratcheted up now a couple of times over the last 3 or 4 years, but importantly, the proposal is to make this a binding target. Is that correct?
That's indeed correct. I think maybe for those listeners which are not familiar with the EU as a whole, these legislations which we're putting in place, some of those are regulations. So that means that member states essentially have to take the legal text and implement it straight away. Other pieces of legislations are called what is called directives. So you put requirements in place, and then member states have the freedom to implement those requirements, but they have to make sure that it happens. And indeed, for the Energy Efficiency Directive, what we're saying is that as an EU as a whole, well, if you compare it to the previous target, we had a minus 32.5% target. Now it needs to be minus 36% in terms of final energy and minus 39% in terms of primary energy. Mm. And it really means that the member states need to achieve that in 2030 collectively. Mm. Now, that is, of course, quite difficult to implement. So how can you make sure if one member state doesn't do its job, that member state which is responsible is kind of taking action. So what the Energy Efficiency Directive does now, and that's actually what is what's happened also in the Renewable Energy Directive, is that it sets benchmarks. So every member state, based on its GDP, based on its energy intensity, based on its cost effective potential to increase energy efficiency, will have a benchmark. And with that benchmark, we check whether that member state actually does sufficiently enough to get to that collective EU binding target. And then, of course, if we don't achieve that EU binding target, we have what is now called kind of a gap delivery measures, which can take different forms, but making sure that each member state does its part in order to get to these collective targets.
So that's something that is then monitored in the lead up to 2030, and some of those additional supporting mechanisms come into place if the member state isn't on track. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So it actually already happened in 2018. So in the past, we would have renewable energy reporting, which happened at the beginning and at the end. And already in 2018, we said, okay, oh, sorry, you have renewable energy reporting and energy efficiency reporting separately. What we already did in 2018, it says, okay, that doesn't make any sense, you know, because energy efficiency, renewable energy, but also CO2 reducing measures, they are complementary to each other. So in 2018, we asked member states already to develop what is called national energy and climate plans, which they need to update regularly. So every 2 years, they need to update those plans. And we use this every year, actually, with what is called the State of the Energy Union report, to report on the progress of each member state. What happened in 2018 is that the renewable energy target member states put pledges forward, some of them well beyond the benchmarks which we set. So they actually exceeded the renewable energy target. But for energy efficiency, we didn't manage to get to a minus 32.5%, and we got stuck at the minus 29.5%. So what essentially this does is say, okay, that's not enough. We need to make sure that we achieve those targets. And if you don't achieve those targets, those member states who don't do enough, they need to contribute in another way to get to those European targets. So yeah, monitoring is, of course, monitoring verification is one of the key elements there. And maybe to quickly add to that, the Energy Efficiency Directive is the one which we've changed now in this Fit for 55 package. But of course, there are other policies which are already in place and which will continue to drive or will be revised, such as the Energy Performance for Buildings Directives or our products directives, ensuring the energy efficiency of products, which will of course supplement and complement this these higher level binding targets in the Energy Efficiency Directive.
And I understand, just you talk about the energy performance of buildings and the disclosure, the regime that sits around that. I understand that's under review, and there's another paper that is coming in the next few months that is addressing what that looks like moving forward as well.
Yes, indeed. So the 2018 got also a revision of the Energy Performance of Buildings Directives, where, of course, we strengthened the requirements for new buildings, so what we call net zero energy buildings. We also put in more requirements, like you said, for reporting, and we also put more requirements in there to essentially accommodate what we see is the digitalization of our energy system. Mm-hmm. So we even introduced there what we call a smartness indicator, making also sure that those people living in houses can make sure that the house, which is essentially an asset in our energy system, can use those assets, either as thermal storage, demand response, but also the connection between your home, the production of renewable energy on your roof, and of course your electric vehicle, which we see more and more happening. So this is also an element which we already introduced in the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive. Now there we're looking at the moment, is this sufficient to achieve that higher target of what I said, the minus 36 and the minus 39%, and where do we need to strengthen those requirements such that we can meet our objectives?
The way you described it is really resonates with me. It's the idea that buildings are no longer sort of, you know, boxes hanging off the end of our energy system. They really are our energy system, and we need to start thinking about them that way as the constituent units of our energy system. And I suppose that is a nice segue into something that you mentioned earlier, which is that the kind of the three pillars of the largest chunk of decarbonisation that you're contemplating in the EU are covered off by efficiency, renewables and electrification. And those three things support each other and interact with each other in really important ways. Do you just want to speak to that for a moment?
Let me start with an anecdote. I had an Aussie friend, which after I left Australia, came to visit me when I was living in the UK. And he walked through my house and he pointed at these big chunky things in every room. And he said, "What are those?" Those are radiators. He says, "Yeah, I already thought so, but why do you have a radiator in every room? I really thought that, of course, you need heat in Europe, but I didn't think you had radiators in every single room." And I think that's an important element to recognize. 50% of our energy consumption is heating and cooling. A big chunk of that is done in industry, but the other big chunk is in buildings. And there we only see 20% of that being kind of decarbonized, and actually mainly biomass. So there is a large chunk of energy which is still fossil natural gas, and in some actually EU member states coal, to provide that heat. So that's one of the things which we now need to tackle. Renewable energy, of course, can be used there. Energy efficiency is key in terms of building insulation, etc. But what we see more and more in terms of also the costs is that actually electrification of that heating sector is becoming much more cost competitive. The market for heat pumps is growing year on year. And essentially, of course, heat pumps and electrification can't go without energy efficiency. So, you know, we are developing those policies such that you reduce your heating requirements, and then electrification becomes, of course, much more cost competitive vis-a-vis the direct use of facing the fossil fuels with all renewable energy use. Now, that kind of triangle of renewable energy efficiency and electrification, we also see in the transport sector, and we also see it in industry. I'm surprised actually with the shift in perspective of industry between 2018 when we did the first package and now. I remember discussions with the chemical industry saying, you know, electrification is something which is on the drawing board. It's still in the R&D phase. Yes, we might be able to do it in 2050. Whereas today, for example, the chemical industry is saying electrification will be the main way how we drive our industrial processes. And for everything we can't do, we might be able to use renewable hydrogen, which is essentially an indirect form of electrification because you use your electricity to convert it into a gas. So that kind of triangle is critically important. And of course, that electrification by itself increases energy efficiency.
Hey team, Katie back in EEC HQ has asked me to tell all of you that we're about to run the last Certified Energy Manager course, not just for 2021, but probably for the next 12 months. Now, if you don't know what a Certified Energy Manager is, it's a 5-day training course and an examination process which allows you to build and verify your skills in energy management. And that can be useful whether you're working within a business, whether you have responsibility for energy and carbon issues within that organisation, or indeed you're supporting businesses on their energy management journey. It's a cracking course that we run in association with the Association of Energy Engineers in the United States, and has been a real cornerstone of professional development in the US, in Australia, and indeed around the world in our industry for a long time now. So if that sounds like it's of interest, I recommend you visit the Energy Efficiency Council website, eec.org.au/training. As I said, this won't run again for 12 months, and applications close on the 28th of September. So get on it. Now, back to the show. And it's a really interesting point you make about the role of hydrogen, and particularly renewable hydrogen, as being part of the electricity supply chain. When we get to that point, and so it's, you're starting to see an all-electric economy that can start to emerge. How do you think about the technologies that you leverage in different parts of the economy? So you might be looking at heat pumps in buildings and for low temperature process heat, but potentially needing hydrogen for high temperature processes or as a feedstock or the like. It sounds like you're thinking a very granular way about the transition pathways in different parts of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I have to say that technology is also advancing very, very rapidly. Mm. So I think, indeed, when you talked about 2 years ago, there was a big distinction between kind of low temperature heat, which you actually in Europe can also be done a lot with the direct application of heat. Mm. Ground source, geothermal heat. We have now low temperature heating district networks, waste heat of industry, using that to provide some of those kind of low temperature heat requirements. So I think in terms of low temperature heat, you actually have quite a number of applications which are available. Solar thermal, for example, which actually now in industry we're also seeing picked up. Denmark has some excellent examples of really developing kind of large scale, cheap solar thermal installations. Mm. But also in terms of high temperature applications, indeed, previously it was seen that either biomass would be required or hydrogen. But you see now thermoelectric boilers in some of the, not even R&D, but actually demonstration phases, which are supplying heat requirements all the way up to 1500 degrees. Mm. So here you also see technology shifting quite rapidly. And I think one of the guiding principles, and that is also now in our policy, is that with any of the technologies, we have to kind of apply this energy efficiency first principle. What makes the most sense also from an energy efficiency perspective? So here, does it make sense to convert electricity into renewable hydrogen and then have, of course, two steps of energy efficiency losses on the way? Or would it be making much more sense also energetically to directly electrify, missing out on one of those areas where you kind of lose efficiency?
And in terms of, if we stick for a moment with the industrial transformation, what does the Fit for 55 program have to say about supporting industry through that transition, given there's a lot of diversity in terms of processes in that space? It's a lot less homogenous than the building sector and potentially more challenging. That's certainly the way we think about it here in Australia. Are there specific measures that are focused on supporting industry on that journey?
Yes, of course. One of the key cornerstones to support the transition in the industry sector has been also in the past is the European Emissions Trading Scheme. So that gives you already the price incentive for industry for both energy efficiency or using renewable energy. And there, I don't know if people in Australia have been following the prices in Europe, but last week, or actually 2 days ago, we had again a record high where the price went up to 60 euros per ton of CO2. So that's really, really a driver there. But of course, this only applies to the bigger industries. Now, for the smaller industries, there is actually a whole array of policies which are being put forward. One of them is essentially in the Energy Efficiency Directive, requiring any company. We have two categories there, the ones which consume more than 100 terajoule per year, which needs to have energy management systems in place. And then for the small and medium-sized enterprises, we make sure that there are energy audits every couple of years. And those there have also been kind of reviewed to say that we should not only look at energy efficiency, but look at energy efficiency and renewable energy in connection with each other. So making that and allowing that also to become more cost effective so that industries can choose either to put energy efficiency in place or maybe now as renewable electricity becomes cheaper to set up a direct power purchase agreement with a local power producer. So there's also a drive kind of from the bottom up to make sure that every single company is doing that. Last but not least, and we haven't talked about that a lot, but of course the European Commission has now what we call, well, essentially a new budget. And there the budget, again, climate action is streamlined. So a lot of the policies, also the financing becoming available for regions to kind of help with the energy transition. Funding for energy efficiency measures is one of the key drivers for these activities.
So you mentioned the role of the ETS in kind of providing that sort of price signal for industry. There's been a decision or to propose applying effectively a parallel ETS to the bill environment sector. I guess I've got two questions. Why sort of these parallel mechanisms in Australia, for example, when we, in that brief period where we had a price on carbon, we had an economy-wide price on carbon that was due to transition to ETS in due course. Why is Europe taking this approach of having sort of specific market mechanisms in parallel, about ones that sort of have founded on similar principles for specific sectors of the economy?
I think the answer is there is in your question. It's a market mechanism, and we indeed see those the industries, the large scale industries, as kind of different markets in that you have professionals really running industrial plants, power generation plants, etc. So the capacities to kind of engage in those markets, to buy, sell carbon credits, to invest a whole portfolio of potential actions to make sure that you reduce your emissions is much higher than in a household. I don't know how many of us have a spreadsheet where, you know, we have all of the CO2 emission reduction options of a house listed.
I know one or two people that might.
You want to see?
But it's a very, exactly. Very, very small demographic.
I'm one of those. And so to kind of check, okay, which is the next action I can take, which is the best buck for the money. So there we see kind of, you know, different markets. We see that the carbon price is important to drive these the decisions. But we also see, for example, in the buildings and in the transport sector that new professionals are coming into play there. You know, the utilities, etc., helping the households to make that happen. So that's why in an initial stage, those are same principles but separate markets for now. But then as we expand over time, develop over time, of course, those could become connected.
So really, it sort of goes back to that need to be thinking in a very grounded way about the opportunities and challenges that are facing each different part of the economy and have very tailored specific policies to support that transition. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair. And this is also why I mentioned this, this what we call this social transition fund as one of the key pillars. And actually, when we presented a Fit for 55 package, and we presented it to the you know, our elected officials, our European parliamentarians, that's where most of the questions came from. I think in Europe, we all see the need to get to climate neutrality in 2050 as soon as possible. We know there's action needed, but at the same time, people continue, and rightly so, to be concerned that some parts of the economy are left out. And that's certainly one of the important elements, making sure that everyone can benefit from this energy transition.
So, to pop it up a level, I'm interested in, you know, your reflections, having sort of got to the end of this process. Obviously, a massive achievement to have these proposals out in the market, and the ability to have them being debated and discussed in the European context. What's the response been, and what are the next steps to actual confirmation and ultimately implementation?
The response, maybe I'm biased, but the response I feel has been relatively positive. The way we framed it, of course, is that the EU member states already agreed at the beginning of the year that they want to have 55% greenhouse gas emission reductions in 2030. That's what they agreed upon. That's now in law. And what we're doing is saying, okay, this is what you agreed upon, and this is what we think are the best measures to achieve that target. Mm-hmm. If you as member states or European parliamentarians have better ideas in order to achieve that target, let us know, because this, of course, we're going into this negotiation. Member states and parliament can both, on both sides, come up with amendments. Mm-hmm. And they, at the end of the day, need to agree with each other on the package as it looks like. But we think that, like, what we put in place now is sufficiently comprehensive to ensure that we have we meet those targets. One of the biggest challenges for us has been, and this is in any government, I would say, is to coordinate internally. Mm. So previously you worked, I'm in what you would call the Ministry of Energy. You work with your colleagues within the Ministry of Energy. But now, you know, as much as I work with my own colleagues, I had to work with the colleagues which are working on the climate issues, on the emissions trading scheme, the colleagues which work in the taxation issue under the Energy Taxation Directive, the colleagues in the Department of Transport, which were looking at, for example, charging stations or hydrogen refueling stations, colleagues in the industry sector, making sure that the industry remains here in Europe. So this is one of the big challenges on our side, and this will also be challenging in the negotiations because, of course, you already see it in member states itself. Different ministries have different point of view. How do we make sure that this whole package remains consistent, and that you don't change pieces of legislation which will have negative impacts on the efficiency of other policy proposals? And so this will be another year and a half, I would say, mm-hmm. before this is done. But of course, you know, the 2018 package has come into force. So it is not that while we're negotiating these packages, nothing has happened. We already have a comprehensive package that was adopted in 2018, and member states are implementing this. So this year and a half is not lost. We already, you know, working at a member state level to develop those policies. Hopefully in the end of 2022, we will have those packages in place, and then of course member states still get some time to implement it, but well before, of course, the targets of 2025. And as soon as we have those agreements, then of course there is the certainty also for businesses to step up their activities and make the best of it, because we really see this as an economic opportunity.
Mm, that's a great note to end on. I'm really passionate about connecting with experts around the world that can talk to the experience in nations beyond our borders, because while, you know, exactly what works in Europe is you can't take that and necessarily just transplant it to Australia. It does broaden the mind, Root, about what is possible, the variety of particularly policy solutions, but also the opportunities that are available to business and householders to work their way through that transition, and that that commitment to almost a principle that's kind of inherent in the Paris Agreement, in continually increasing ambition, setting targets, sort of having those enabling policies sitting under it, developing a level of comfort in that, but not resting on your laurels and always looking ahead to how we can continue to ramp up that momentum is something that's very instructive, something I think we could learn from here in Australia. So I really appreciate you making the time, and it's been a great pleasure for me to be talking to someone that was kind of building this from the inside and having that sort of deep technical knowledge of how that policy has been put together. So thank you for your time, and good luck as you continue to sort of take this set of proposals forward, hopefully towards a successful implementation in due course.
Yeah, and thank you. And like you said, broaden your mind. I would like to remind everyone I was educated in Australia. So any intellectual capacity I put into this policy, I give the credit to you guys. Well, so thank you very much.
I can report that there's more than a couple of Aussies running around Europe making a contribution in various organisations over there, as well as people that have connections as you do in their personal history. So we're glad to be making that contribution as well. So thank you, Root.
Thank you, and have a good day.
All right, well, that wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, you can find us on Twitter. You'll find Root at Energy Root. That's RUUD. And my handle is, of course, at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management, and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at EE Council. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@ec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And of course, many of these episodes are recorded live. The next one is going to be a super interesting one where we dig into the proposed changes to the residential energy efficiency provisions in the National Construction Code. To join that episode live and lob a question to our guests, you can visit ec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.